You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of IAS 2009, the 5th International AIDS Society Conference on HIV Pathogenesis, Treatment, and Prevention. The conference took place in Cape Town, South Africa, from July 19th through July 22nd, 2009.
As you may know, that about 2003... 2002, 2003, when there was the push for treatment and the advocacy to scale up treatment and growing interest to scale up treatment, especially in low-income countries, many, many said that it could not be done. The health systems were way too weak. This wasn't something that could be achieved. And as we know, we have now currently 4 million people globally on treatment. And the big question is, how have we done it? At the same time, we know that up to almost 7 million more need treatment. And the scale-up that has happened in countries, one of the barriers that has been identified is that we have serious deficiencies in health systems. We've gotten to the point where it's very difficult to continue putting more and more people on treatment without addressing the issue of weak health systems. What does it mean when we talk about health systems being weak? WHO has a definition for health systems as all organizations, people, and facilities, everything that is working together to promote and improve health. So when we look at that, and has divided it into about six elements: service delivery, health financing, information, technologies including essential medicines, leadership and governance, and if I have left, and health workforce. Globally, we have a shortage of about 4.3 million healthcare workers. In Africa alone, we need an additional 1 million more doctors, nurses, and midwives to address the demands for healthcare. How can we begin to scale up to cover the 7 million that need treatment if we are not able to continue to increase the numbers of healthcare workers that need to do this job? Why now? Why have a press conference on HIV and health systems? It's because we have learned a number of lessons and we've made some progress, and many of our speakers are going to speak to this. But I just want to, coming from the International AIDS Society, we had a meeting just before the beginning of this conference funded by the Rockefeller Foundation to examine this issue and look at the research, look at what methodologies we need to measure this impact, and also identify some policy priorities for moving forward. But we know that we are going through an economic crisis, and this is the point at which we have to look at what we can do with the money we've got, and also how we can use the lessons from HIV to drive progress. And there is a mood globally and some changes at the international level that also compel us to work more closely on this issue. As you may know, President Obama has announced a few weeks ago a comprehensive global health strategy. And also more and more countries are asking that we make progress on other health-related Millennium Development Goals, as 2015 is not very far. So I would wish to close there and leave the rest for the panelists and say the reason that we are having this press conference is to increase the understanding amongst the public, to share with you some of the findings we've got, and to provide you with this opportunity to ask us questions on some of the issues that you may have been hearing at this conference or before. So to get us started, I wish to introduce Professor Alan Whiteside, who was born in Kenya and grew up in Swaziland, where he attended Waterford College. He completed a BA in Development Studies, a Master's in Development Studies at the University of East Anglia. He holds an economic he holds a doctorate in economics from the University of Natal, and is currently the Director of the Health Economics and AIDS Research Division at the University of KwaZulu-Natal.
Great. I think there are four key points that we need to be aware of. And as we look at this conference, which is being held here in Cape Town, and welcome to Cape Town. Those of you who are from outside South Africa, welcome to South Africa. The weather is being kind to us, by the way, for those of you who know Cape Town. We're being very lucky. Four key points. The first one is that HIV and AIDS has brought huge amounts of money to health, and it works across all of the health sector. And I think it's really important that we understand two things. The first is that the health system is rather like our own bodies. If any of you have an ingrowing toenail or a migraine, then you all feel bad. Your entire body feels bad. In exactly the same way, as if there is something wrong with one part of the health system, then the whole thing doesn't work. And we need to understand that the health system is an integrated organism, and that HIV is beneficial to it, and has been and will continue to be. As Stephen Lewis said last night, it is disingenuous to divide the health sector. We are not divided. We stand together wanting better health in all areas, but understanding that in some parts of the world, AIDS is absolutely exceptional and is an emergency. The second point I want to make is a troubling one for me to have to say, and that is that we've probably got about as much money as we're going to get. I think, realistically, we need to continue to call for more resources, but we also need to start spending what we have better and better. And I think that that is a growing realization that we're seeing around the field and around people working in HIV. We also call for resources and fail to acknowledge that it's not just money, it is also, as Jackie alluded to, human resources that are so terribly critical in moving against this epidemic. We've heard about doctors being poached from the poor world, and doctors and nurses, and I think there are things we can start doing to deal with this. One of them would be the idea of perhaps setting up a tax where if an organization employs people from the poor world, they're required to pay into a fund or to provide an equivalent person to that country. The third point I want to make is that holding people accountable is absolutely critical. It's very easy to stand up and say the G8 must deliver on their promises. And we must do that and continue to do that. But it is also critical that we hold our own governments in Africa accountable, not just in terms of providing treatment, but also in dealing with some of the issues where they have failed to understand discrimination. And I think, again, of what Stephen said last night around the issues of homosexuality and men having sex with men. And the final thing I want to say is that we also need to recognize that HIV is a long-term problem. It means that we are going to need continued aid going into the future for the next 20 or 30 years in some countries. Countries that are poor face dealing with an expensive disease, and AIDS is expensive. And what we require is not just funding, but commitments going forward into the future to build health systems to deal with AIDS and the other many problems that we face in the health sector, and to ensure that we are able to meet the Millennium Development Goals.
Thank you, Alan. I now wish to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Wafa El Sadr, who is the director of the International Center for AIDS Care and Treatment Programs at the Center for Infectious Disease Epidemiologic Research at Columbia University. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Jacqueline. And I'll just add a few words to Alan's, largely building on some of the discussions we had at the meeting on health systems strengthening day before, 2 days ago, was it? 2 days ago. And one of them is that we have to acknowledge, first of all, that health systems in poor countries as they're structured today are often unable to meet the needs, most of the needs of people within the communities. They're really based on rather discontinuous treatments of people coming in only when they're very sick, receiving probably some intervention, and then they go back to the community and they either get better or don't get better, but there's not a sense of an investment in the health of the community or the health of the person or the health of the family, and not a sense of the need for continuity, for keeping people in care to prevent illness as well as to treat illness. So if that's the norm, we have to acknowledge that HIV has challenged that and transformed it in a very fundamental ways. And I think that's an accomplishment that people who work in HIV, I think they don't boast enough about it and they don't talk about it enough. And what has it meant? It's meant that in order, because we recognize that HIV is a chronic disease, people with HIV have HIV for their life, is that it involves transforming the healthcare system and all its elements, whether it be the healthcare workers and their attitudes, the facilities and how they're structured, the systems of follow-up and appointments, the way we interact with the communities themselves, to transform them into a very different kind of a system, one that's much more vested into long-term outcomes for people, and that's one that's much more invested in a partnership with the community and the people that utilize these facilities. And also it involves not only thinking about how does one change the delivery itself, but also how does one think about sustaining and funding these activities for the long term. So HIV, in a way, and the success we've had over the last few years in the scale-up has been accompanied by transformative changes. And I think the push should be to really to expand that and to push on that and to build on it as a platform that has the potential to really transform the systems as a whole for everybody, not just for people with HIV. Now, why has there been also this? So there are a couple of ways in thinking about the outputs of the healthcare system, and one is what do we want to accomplish? We want to accomplish better outcomes for people with HIV, hopefully with the HIV programs that has been demonstrated with some of the important improvements in survival and so on. But also, I think one of the other outcomes is that people with HIV and people supporting HIV programs are also interested in the other outcomes. They're very interested in enhancing maternal health. They're very interested in enhancing child health, because it's intrinsic piece and parcel of doing high quality HIV programming. So in a way, it's in the interest of HIV programs to ensure that the systems are strengthened, the services are strengthened, the whole structure is strengthened. So, and actually to ensure that there are benefits that go beyond HIV itself. I do believe that there's a need. I agree with Alan, the whole issue in the meeting we discussed to a large extent, also the need for investments on the long run. And the issue is that these programs need to be sustained, whatever they are, whether they're for HIV, for any other program. A commitment on the long term is very critical. And HIV programs started out as emergency programs, and that's in the word PEPFAR even. It's an emergency program, but it has to be transformed now into a durable program that's part and parcel of the package of sustainable services and activities and systems that are available for people who live in the countries most affected by HIV.
Thank you. So now the discussion is open to take questions. Yes. Yes, the good news is that Professor Michel Kazachkin is on his way. He's just finished his session. But the discussion is open to take questions from you. First question, please. And Stu, please step to the mic. Yes, thank you.
Alan and Doctor, how in South Africa, what we see today, the biggest bottleneck to provision of health services is the human resource constraint, that this is the, if there's one single factor more than money and more than drug supply, it's the human resource constraint. I wonder if you'd care to comment on the WHO's position on task shifting and what can be done to build the sense that people at grassroots level can be empowered to virtually run ART programs, run TB programs, and can the same human resource then can be linked up to deal with other chronic diseases that are very closely allied such as hypertension, diabetes, and obesity, for example, to make a package that could be sold in an attractive way, and what you as part of the research community could do to push that rather big wheelbarrow up the steep hill.
Thank you.
Right. I think there is an awful lot in that question, and I think perhaps there are two things that we need to be doing. Well, first of all, we have got some work recently which looked at the links between HIV and the delivery of health services. It's taken from the demographic and health surveys, and it basically looked at a number of countries. And what we find is that the higher your HIV, even with all the resources that are going into healthcare, the worse your outcomes, because they're simply not the doctors, nurses, etc. So what I think we need to do is two things. First of all, we need to be producing more healthcare workers. And I find it quite incredible that we haven't scaled up our healthcare worker output. You know, South Africa, unfortunately, is still business as usual. And I go back to Zimbabwe in 1990, where there was a meeting held in Harare talking about the needs for healthcare workers, and they blindly didn't consider HIV and what effect it would have on the healthcare system. So what we need to do is we need to train plus because we need more, and plus again because we are going to lose certain numbers of people in terms of the epidemic. The second thing we need to do is, you're absolutely right, task shifting and community orientation. If you go to Malawi and Zambia, we have a cadre of health workers called medical officers. These are people who are not fully doctors, and they're more trained than nurses, but there are cadres that we can look at. You go to Swaziland, you've got the community care workers, and I think what we need to be is generous and willing to look at innovative ways. But at the same time, we need to understand that delivering drugs is a complex issue. So I hope that answers your question.
I'll just add a couple of words. I think in a very fundamental way, one of the reasons I think that one can build on the platform of HIV is this whole concept of a chronic disease. I mean, HIV is a chronic infection. It is a chronic disease. And the framework and the programs that are established to do HIV are really chronic disease programs. Nonetheless, we've somehow compartmentalized HIV as different. But I do think that there are lots of synergies and potential for utilizing these systems for HIV to deal with other chronic conditions that are largely neglected in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa and elsewhere, including cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, mental illness, for example, and many, many others. So I think it's thinking, we have to be smart, and we have to think about where we intersect, and we have to build bridges across people rather than dividing between people, and bring the HIV community and the other communities together, so we can actually build on what's been already learned in through the building of HIV-related programs. I do think that task shifting is very critical. It's very important, as Alan mentioned, in many countries. There's been very successful task shifting and task sharing that's taking place. There are challenges in how does one institutionalize these new cadres of workers? How can they not be marginalized within the healthcare system? How can they be appreciated, remunerated, and also recognized? And that's also very important. And HIV programs are trying, and others are trying now, to advocate that these are not marginal members of the health workforce. They're integral part of the health workforce, and probably are one of the most important, because they're the ones who reach out to the community and to the homes.
Thank you, Wafa. Before we move on, I'd like to welcome Professor Michelle Kazachkin, who's just joined us, and please welcome him. And I wish to introduce him. He's the Executive Director of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria since April of 2007. Dr. Kazachkin has spent the last 25 years fighting AIDS. And as a leading physician, researcher, administrator, his career is quite exemplary. But prior to joining the Global Fund, he was the professor of immunology at the university. My French is not very good to pronounce this.
René Descartes.
René Descartes, yes. And authored and co-authored over 500 articles in peer-reviewed journals. Thank you, Michel.
Thank you very much, Jacqueline.
I apologize for being late. I was chairing the session in the U.S. I just came out of the room. And I wouldn't wish to repeat things that Wafa or Alan have already said and that have already been discussed. Let me just say two, three things on this issue of health systems, and then I'll be pleased to join the discussion. First, I'd like to say that I'd like to dispel the myth that the Global Fund or PEPFAR or Gavi are not funding health systems or are just, you know, funding pills and commodities. In fact, Global Fund and PEPFAR are clearly the largest funders of health systems globally, currently. Both PEPFAR and Global Fund invest about 35% of the money they spend in countries in what you would call health systems, that is infrastructure, health workforce, monitoring and evaluation, procurement, supply chain management. At the Global Fund, 23%, let's say 25%, one quarter of all the resources that we that are going to countries, one quarter of these resources goes to support the health workforce, mm-hmm. be it for task shifting, community strengthening, training, salaries, one quarter. And so for the $16 billion that the Global Fund has invested so far, this means basically $4 billion invested in the last 6 years in the health workforce. And second, let me also, you know, dispel, but I'm sure you've done that, and I think I heard you, Wafa, just as I was entering, the myth of, you know, one or the other. Of course, there isn't such a thing as either you fund health systems or you fund the fight against diseases, because obviously you cannot scale up HIV treatment or prevention if you do not sustain the systems at the same time. On the other hand, why would you like to build system if it isn't to deliver care? And let's say in the high burden environment for HIV, TB, and malaria, where we are in sub-Saharan Africa, it would just be a nonsense to sort of dissociate in any way health system strengthening from vertical funding. And let me just give one example from this region, which I think is extremely, to me, a very strong illustration of what we mean by the AIDS response driving strengthening of health systems. Lesotho came in 2002 or 2003 with a request to the Global Fund for the funding of 3,000 patients on antiretroviral treatment. And I remember at that time I was in the technical review panel of the Global Fund that we were somehow scared by Lesotho jumping into willing to 2002, you know, is very long time ago, into engaging into treating 3,000 patients without really any infrastructure, any trained person, and so on. Last year, in round 8, Lesotho succeeded with a grant at the Global Fund for treating 55,000 patients. That is ensuring 65% coverage of their needs. Now, if Lesotho could move from 3,000 to 50,000, 55,000 patients as an objective in somewhere 4 years' time, it clearly means that the funding they have received for AIDS, for TB, has allowed them to build the platforms to be able to deliver the services now to 55,000 people. If that is not health system strengthening, then I really wonder what health strengthening health systems might be.
Thank you, Michelle. We can take more questions now. Yes, as I might pose some questions to our speakers. The first, during the meeting we had before the conference, we talked about the issue of total health spending and how much money is spent on health globally. I'm sure Alan would be in a better position to recall the exact figure, but we reflected on the current economic crisis. And a leading health economist told us that actually usually total health spending is a function of a country's GDP, so that if they're getting richer, these countries usually spend more on health. And what happens in a recession is that countries have less money and therefore spend less on health, and especially low and middle income countries. However, the rich countries seemed, at least in past recessions, to have been fairly what he called recession-proof. And for countries, especially in Africa, there's a limit, therefore, they can spend based on the function on how much money they've got. Before HIV, this was what we took for granted. There's only so much money, we get a little bit of external assistance, and that's what we spend. But we had a discussion of and asked the question, what's the difference that HIV has made? So I wish to pose this question especially to Professor Kazashkin and to Professor Whiteside to tell us about how HIV allowed us to explore new mechanisms for funding and financing health more broadly, and what this has meant as we move forward in how we examine the question of funding health in countries.
I'm reminded, I'm starting, so he's got a chance to think about it. Is that right?
That's the way to do it.
I'm reminded of the WHO's campaign 3x5, because at the same time as after that was launched, I was challenged by a mutual friend of myself and Michelle's, a lady called Veronique Collard, who said, but it's not enough to provide treatment, it needs to be free. So at the same time as the 3x5 campaign was launched by WHO and rolled out, we did a rather perhaps ineffective academic exercise of getting a petition for free, F-R-E-E by five, saying that we need to roll out treatment. And for me, as we look at what is happening in terms of funding, I think there are two challenges. The first is that we need to see that HIV and AIDS money is building health systems, and that health systems must have the HIV AIDS resources because doctors and nurses are not immune from infection. So that's, I think, the first challenge. The second challenge, and I must re-emphasize this, is the need that governments be held accountable, not just in the North, but also in the South. And linked to that is that there is sustainable funding. Because the decisions around health spending are not made in health ministries, they are made in ministries of finance. And when ministers of finance look at aid flows which are unreliable and fluctuate, then they're inclined to say, no, we can't do it. So we need sustainable, long-term financing.
I'll just make three quick observations. Jacqueline, you obviously asked a very complex question. The first is that what I think AIDS has shown is that when the world decides to go for an objective and comes together around one objective, it can achieve things that otherwise would seem impossible to achieve. And that's how we have seen the tripling, basically, of official development money going to health in the last 6 or 8 years. It has been driven by the effort to fight AIDS. And now we're being told it's very, very difficult to scale up money. You know, I'm sure if in the autumn we have some sort of threat around the influenza pandemic, the money will be found. Last September, we needed money to bail out banks. The money has been found. So it's up to us now to have to find the right advocacy and the right champions and to come with the right results and demonstration of feasibility and benefits to have the money we need to reach universal access. The second comment is that what we've seen with AIDS is not only new resources, but we've seen a lot of innovation, and that was in your question. We've seen new instruments And the Global Fund is one of these instruments with a very different way of addressing how development aid is provided to countries from the traditional top-down bilateral models where it's the donors that were originally deciding on what would be allocated to countries. It's now countries coming with requests on their own needs. And then we've seen innovation in finances, and this was in your question, Jacqueline. We've seen new sources of finance outside the official development aid, and for example, we've seen IFIM, you know, a front-loading strategy on bonds to help finance immunization in children with Gavi. The Global Fund has launched what we call debt to health, where part of the debt that a developing country may have towards a donor country is erased, provided that half of that money is reinvested by the country, by the developing country, the other half, in its health program. So it's changing the inert money that debt is into active and productive money for health. Or for those of you living in the US or in the UK, you're familiar with the RED initiative from the private sector. If you buy, you know, a Gap red t-shirt, or if ladies buy a red Armani dress, or Wafa, I'm sure this happens every week to you, the part of that money will actually go for the fight against AIDS in Africa in Global Fund grants. And this is a totally new initiative, raising money, but also raising awareness and building a network of global solidarity among citizens of the world. So I think the AIDS movement has really not only mobilized resources, but it's really mobilized innovation.
Next question, please.
Yes. A question for Alan. Compared to where we were 10 years ago, it would seem as though the cost of drugs is no longer part of the equation. Yet we did hear the president of Botswana starting to question the sustainability of Botswana's program because it's part of a Bristol-Myers Squibb-linked initiative with a couple of their brand name partners. And on occasion, some of the Gates funding and some of the PEPFAR funding has also been linked, although I believe that's changing now, to patented drugs as opposed to generics. And I know here in South Africa, Aspen Pharmacare's service delivery contract was 30% more expensive than the same drugs could be provided, for example, by Hexal out of India or Cipla or one of the others. So my question would be, do you think in terms of especially the current drugs, but also thinking about second line, which obviously is a growing concern, that the AIDS activists and the AIDS community needs to continue to do more work around the question of drug pricing and access?
I think that the cost of drugs is a huge issue. It absolutely is a huge issue. But I think we need to distinguish between where it is and is not an issue. In South Africa, we can certainly, out of our national exchequer, afford to pay for treatment for everybody who needs it. And I think we need to thank people who are supporting treatment in this country, but recognize that we have a large enough GDP, albeit unequally distributed, that we could provide treatment. That is not the case in Mozambique, where the GDP spend per capita is a mere $14, or in Malawi, where it's Lesotho, where it's $41. So I think we need to understand that the cost of drugs as an issue is not the same everywhere. In high prevalence countries which have low incomes, it will be critical moving forward. We have to continue to press for drug prices to become cheaper. And I think it's GSK who've just announced that they're going to make drugs available. Maybe you could say a word about that. But at the same time, we also need to keep the impetus going on research for new drugs and new combinations and recognize that that is expensive. And maybe then you have to see AIDS treatment in a... if you really want to be innovative, maybe AIDS treatment needs to be in some ways similar to vaccines, where producing new drugs is a global public good. Because unless we do that, then the drug companies will be charging high prices and they will be able to legitimately point to the very expensive costs of producing, researching and developing new drugs.
I just like to make 2 points. One is that I agree it's a huge issue, and it remains a huge issue, and one shouldn't underestimate that it is a huge issue. And actually, I'm seeing the gap somehow between the standards of care in the rich north and in the global south widening, broadening these days. And I'm very concerned. And I was on Saturday in visiting a district hospital, the Yoste Hospital, not far from here, and I met with the physicians and the director of the hospital. They're really facing impossible dilemmas of either moving to better standards of care and then not being able to enroll new patients in their programs, or keeping with standards of care that are not those that the science would recommend at this time. And my second point is that please do not forget, when we, all of us, advocate and discuss the price of drugs, the drugs for multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, of course, in this particular country, it is a major issue. But globally, we're really lagging behind. The Global Fund is basically the only funder at this time, international funder of MDR-TB. It's providing treatment for about 30,000 people, when it is estimated that about 500,000 people contract MDR-TB each year. So if we do not move on this, and on the treatment that currently costs $7,000 per patient per year, we'll just have a dreadful and a tragic epidemic facing us with MDR-TB.
I think there's another issue. I'm sorry. There's another issue just to keep in mind, which is we probably have to acknowledge that one of the key reasons of the success of the scale-up has been the simplicity of the scale-up. I mean, the public health approach, the use of one standard regimen, minimum of monitoring, and so on. And many of even the poorest countries are now facing tremendous pressures, often from outside, to complicate the treatment, to think of more monitoring, to think of more individualized treatment, and so on. It's their pros and cons. Obviously, I don't think we've done very well in the north, where we have a lot of resistance in our patients, and I think we monitor people too much. There's a wastage, as you can imagine. So I think there's kind of a tension that's growing between the challenge of universal coverage, which means you have to scale up and treat many, many more people, two-thirds, more than twice what we now have in treatment, which by necessity means you have to keep it as simple as possible, as doable as possible by wide cadres of healthcare workers with the simplest medications, the simplest monitoring, while at the same time the tension of the gap that Michelle talked about of a different system of a very much of an individualized approach maybe in the north versus much more of an algorithmic public health approach. And that's a very real tension that many of the countries are really feeling intensely.
Thank you very much for coming, and I wish to just highlight that indeed strengthening health systems is a long-term commitment, and that we've all recognized that it's going to take global solidarity and support for poor countries for at least several decades to come. Thank you.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thank you for listening to this report from IAS 2009. For more coverage of this conference, please visit us online at thebodypro.com/IAS2009.